Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, November 9th, 2018, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon's topic is the legal battle to enforce Janus versus AFSCME. My name is Michael Wallen, and I'm the Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Bill Messenger, who is a staff attorney at the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. After our speaker gives his remarks, we will then go to audience Q&A. Thank you for sharing with us today. Bill, the floor is yours.
Thank you, and thank you for the Federal Society for hosting this teleforum. The topic today will be the litigation battle following the Supreme Court's decision Janus versus AFSCME. And the bottom line is there's a lot of litigation going on right now. By my count, there's 49 cases currently pending in the federal courts or state courts that concern Janus-related issues, stretching from whether Janus can be enforced retroactively to enforcing Janus rights moving into the future. But before discussing what litigation comes after Janus, I think first we should discuss exactly what the Supreme Court held in that case and to provide a little bit of background. I guess the most of you on this call are probably already familiar with what Janus held, but for everyone else, just to make sure that everyone's on the same page. And so what the Supreme Court held in Janus is that it's unconstitutional under the First Amendment for the government to compel public employees to pay union dues against their will. Or in other words, the Supreme Court struck down what is known as the union shop or the agency shop, which is a requirement that public employees, as a condition of their employment, join or support a union. Now, union shop or agency shops in the public sector came about in the 1960s, right around that point, and sort of proliferated after that point. And those agency fee requirements sort of raised profound First Amendment issues, you know, right from the very beginning. Because what you have is the government conditioning employment on an individual subsidizing the speech of a special interest group, a union, for the purpose of petitioning or representing their interests before the government. In many ways, these agency fee requirements were analogous to political patronage requirements, which is the old past practice of the government requiring to have a government job that the individual support the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. It's just in terms of agency fees, instead of being forced to support a political party, the individual is forced to support a special interest group closely aligned with a political party. Now, in 1976, the Supreme Court held political patronage requirements to be unconstitutional under the First Amendment. But then 1 year after, in Abood versus Detroit Board of Education, the court reached a contrary decision with respect to compulsory agency fees. And in the case of Abood, which again, 1977, the court held that it was unconstitutional under the First Amendment to compel public employees to pay for so-called political expenses, but not unconstitutional to force those employees to pay for the union's costs of collectively bargaining with the government. So a great deal of compulsory fees were permitted. Now, the dissent in that case, rather presciently, said there's no difference between the two, that collectively bargaining with the government is political and is political speech, and therefore it should be just as unconstitutional to compel public employees to support that collective bargaining. But nevertheless, the Abood framework, which allowed, again, some compulsory fees in the public sector, is what controlled in this country from 1977 until the Supreme Court's decision in June of 2018 in Janus. There was a great deal of litigation between those points that ultimately culminated in Janus, but the story of that litigation, I think, is a story for another day of how Janus eventually came about. But the bottom line holding in Janus was that the court overruled Abood and held it unconstitutional across the board for the government to compel public employees to subsidize a union. And as part of Janus, the court held three things in addition to its holding, or to clarify its holding, which are very important for litigation that has followed. The first is the court held that a public sector union cannot take an employee's money without their prior affirmative consent. And this was important because prior to Janus, the court unions took the position that they could take an employee's money unless and until that individual objected. And then the unions would put a lot of procedural hurdles in front of that individual to make it difficult for that individual to object. So, for example, in California, the California Teachers Association would require that an individual object each and every single year to paying union dues, or the union would take political expenses from them. And then the individual would have to do it again the next year and the next year. But Janice ended that by making clear that a union cannot take an employee's money without their prior affirmative consent. The second thing the court held is that prior consent has to amount to a waiver of First Amendment rights. And so the court put a standard on what that consent has to look like. And a waiver of First Amendment rights has to be knowingly made, clearly made, and voluntarily made. So in order for a union to take an individual's money or have the government take it, the union has to show that the individual's consent amounts to a First Amendment waiver. And that'll play very heavily into the litigation that's come after that. And then finally, the Supreme Court indicated that exclusive representation of employees in and of itself infringes on First Amendment associational rights. The court noted that exclusive representation is an impingement on associational rights that wouldn't be tolerated in other contexts. And the thought is that that language may suggest that the court may be willing to look at exclusive representation, which will be one of the topics we talk about today. So that's the court's holding in Janus. So now moving to the cases following Janus, which again, I count them to be about 49. And I sort of put them into three different categories. One are retroactive cases, which I call clawback cases, that seek to obtain relief for employees for violations of their rights prior to the Janus decision in June of this year. The second group of cases are prospective cases that seek to enforce employees' rights under Janus moving forward in the future and to eliminate union obstacles to enforcing those rights. And then the final category of cases are cases to extend Janus into other areas, mainly dealing with private sector employment or exclusive representation. And so what I'd like to do is go through each of those categories, talk about the cases in those categories and the major issues, and then open it up to questions about any of those different groups of cases. So we'll start with retroactive. And these are the clawback cases. What these cases seek is that the unions return agency fees taken from employees prior to the Supreme Court's decision in Janus. By my count, there are 34 such cases already on the books right now, most of which are filed as class actions seeking a return of money that the unions wrongfully took in the past. Now, retroactivity is actually not an issue here, or a problem, rather, with these cases. Supreme Court constitutional decisions are retroactive. Because when the Supreme Court says what the First Amendment means, the First Amendment has always meant that. The court is not inventing something new. But nevertheless, there are two issues that are going to be in most of these cases that will probably decide the outcome of these various clawback cases. The first of which is class certification. Unless a case is certified as a class action, the amount of money at issue in each case, you know, is not very significant. There's not necessarily one particular issue that's an impediment to class certification in these cases, but obviously the unions will come up with, you know, anything they can to say there's a class conflict or some other reason the case shouldn't be certified as a class. So expect a lot of litigation, you know, over whether or not these cases can in fact be certified. The lead case on class certification, I would say, is probably the Seventh Circuit case, or a case in the Seventh Circuit called Riffey v. Rauner. It's a foundation case. It's actually Harris versus Quinn, which was a Supreme Court decision from 2014 that held it unconstitutional for unions to seize money from Medicaid providers. After that case was decided, it went back to the district court, mainly the determination of whether it would be a class action. The district court denied class certification. The Seventh Circuit upheld that, but then the Supreme Court reversed it in a case following Janus and remanded the decision back to the Seventh Circuit to reconsider its decision in light of Janus. So that case right now is sitting at the Seventh Circuit, and we're awaiting an opinion on whether it thinks a class certification is appropriate in light of the court's decision in Janus. The second issue in the clawback cases, and this will probably be the big one that really determines the failure success of most of them, is the so-called good faith defense. The unions are arguing in all of these cases, every clawback case, that if they had a good faith belief that their fee seizures were constitutional at the time, that immunizes them from liability under Section 1983 for paying damages for taking those fees. So basically, they're raising what's often called a good faith defense. Now, the counterargument is that there is no such thing as a good faith defense to Section 1983 liability. Mistake of law has never been a cognizable defense. And in cases that did recognize a so-called good faith defense in the past, it was because it was an element of the particular constitutional claim at issue. And that the courts did not hold that there is a good faith defense to all claims, much less to a First Amendment claim. And then the backup argument is even if there was a good faith defense, the unions didn't act in good faith because the Supreme Court noted in Janus, the unions have been on notice for years that their fee seizures were very likely unconstitutional, at least since the court's 2012 decision in Knox, where the court called Abood an anomaly, or 2014 in Harris, where the court basically gave six reasons why Abood should be overruled, that the unions were on notice that they were treading on thin ice by taking these fees. So that's the good faith defense issue. I expect it to be litigated throughout the circuits, and I wouldn't be surprised if the Supreme Court ultimately took up the issue. And not only because of its importance in this litigation, but it's actually even bigger significance outside of just, you know, post-Janus litigation. If the courts were correct, or if the union is correct, that there is a good faith defense, that means there is a good faith defense to all 1983 claims, from racial discrimination claims to statutory claims. Anything that can be brought under 1983, state of mind, mistake of law, would become a defense to that. And the court has come close to looking at this issue several times in the past, so I wouldn't be surprised if in one of these cases the court ultimately took it and resolved once and for all whether or not, you know, private defendants do have a good faith defense to Section 1983 liability for the deprivation of constitutional rights they inflict. So those are the clawback cases, the retroactive cases. The second category are prospective cases that seek to enforce employees' rights under Janus moving forward. And the vast majority of those are cases challenging employees' ability, or when employees can exercise their rights under Janus in the future, and when they can stop the deduction of union dues. Now, as I noted before, the Supreme Court held in Janus that the union cannot take an employee's money without their consent. So any employee who didn't consent prior to Janus, basically the unions have stopped taking money from those individuals almost across the board, just because it's very cut and dry, they can't do it. But that leaves the issue of what about individuals who are union members or who authorized dues deduction prior to Janus? The unions in many states, but also with state assistance, are trying to limit the ability of current union members to stop the deduction of union dues from their paychecks and exercise their Janus rights. So by way of example, New Jersey has passed a law that said any public employee who signed a dues deduction authorization in the past can only revoke it during one 10-day period per year. Or in other words, New Jersey saying you can only exercise your Janus rights, you can't exercise your Janus rights during 355 days of every year, but only during 10 days a year if you authorized dues deduction in the past. Delaware passed a similar law, but with a 15-day period. You're also seeing similar restrictions being put in dues deduction authorizations. So for example, there's a case currently have in Ohio called Smith that's dealing with a restriction that AFSCME has that says individuals who have agreed to dues checkoff or agreed to have dues deducted from their paychecks only can revoke it during one 15-day period per collective bargaining agreement. Now, a collective bargaining agreement is usually 3 years long. So basically, AFSCME is taking the position that anyone who authorized dues deduction in the past can only exercise their Janus rights during one 15-day period about every 1,000 days. So you're seeing significant restrictions on the ability of individual employees to get out. And as you can imagine, there's a number of cases challenging this. I count 19 cases right now that currently have at least one allegation in them challenging these type of revocation windows. And I think probably the primary issue in a lot of these cases is going to go to the issue of waiver. As I mentioned before, the Supreme Court said consent has to amount to a First Amendment waiver. And what the unions are going to argue in most of these revocation cases that deal with individuals who sign dues deduction authorizations is the individual agreed to this restriction. They waive their right to basically get out of the union and stop the dues deduction in the future. If they make that argument, then they should have to prove that dues deduction agreement amounts to a waiver of First Amendment rights, in that it's knowing, it's clear, and it was voluntarily made. So the litigation will very much hinge on that. And one sort of twist on that is that the analysis is slightly different with individuals who signed cards prior to Janus. Because in that case, you know, as I noticed, a waiver has to be knowingly made. The argument can be made that an individual could not have knowingly waived their rights under Janus before Janus was decided, and that therefore any restriction agreed to or dues deduction agreement agreed to prior to Janus is null and void because it couldn't be a knowing waiver of their Janus rights before Janus was decided. So that issue will be litigated in the courts. Now, a slight subset of the revocation cases is waiver cases that basically use that waiver argument more offensively. The argument being that dues deduction agreements signed prior to Janus are just null and void completely because they don't amount to a First Amendment waiver, and therefore states and other public employers shouldn't deduct any union dues or fees from anyone who signed a card prior to Janus because that card can't be considered a valid First Amendment waiver. I count at least two cases that have that kind of waiver claim in them that are currently pending, and that is also an issue, we'll see, of which of these dues deduction agreements, if any, amount to a First Amendment waiver, which in turn will control the degree to which unions and states can restrict individuals' ability to get out of a union and stop the deduction of union dues from their paychecks, as is their right under Janus. So that's the prospective litigation, mainly, as I said, dealing with an individual's ability to exercise their Janus rights prospectively. Turning to the third category, it's extending Janus beyond the court's decision today. And that's really in two areas. The first of which is to the private sector. Janus dealt with a public sector employee, Mark Janus, and it explicitly applies to all public sector employees. However, with respect to private sector employees, the court expressly reserved the question and said, we don't decide private sector employees today, and then noted in a footnote that private sector employment brings up additional issues. The main issue is state action. Is there state action sufficient to trigger First Amendment in the private sector, mainly meaning under the National Labor Relations Act and under the Railway Labor Act? And the court noted there's a circuit split on that issue of state action under at least the National Labor Relations Act. Under the Railway Labor Act, there's not really a circuit split because the Supreme Court in Hansen and later in Ellis found state action under the Railway Labor Act. So I wouldn't be surprised to see cases in the future dealing with constitutionality of compulsory fees under either the NLRA or the RLA. Right now, there are no cases on that, to my knowledge. There was one in the past brought by the Right to Work Foundation called CERNA, but unfortunately it came too soon, reached the Supreme Court when it was deadlocked 4-4 after Justice Scalia's death. So as of now, there is no litigation on this topic, but again, I wouldn't be surprised if we saw it in the future. And then the final one to extend Janus is to exclusive representation of individuals. So exclusive representation is where the government forces an individual to accept a union as their representative or agent for dealing with the government. And of course, in Janus, the court said you can't be forced to subsidize that exclusive representative. But that brings up the next question as well. If you can't be forced to subsidize this mandatory agent, why can you be forced to accept it at all? Why can you be forced to accept an organization, you know, to speak on your behalf if you don't want it to speak on your behalf? And there's a number of cases challenging the constitutionality of exclusive representation. There's a total of 9 to my count, but they're sort of in different categories. The first group was actually filed prior to Janus, but after Harris versus Quinn. And it challenges exclusive representation of individuals who are not public employees, but who are independent Medicaid providers. More specifically, by around 2000 or so, several states came up with the idea of imposing mandatory union representation on individuals who aren't public employees, but just receive some public money for their services, mainly Medicaid providers who provide home-based services to people with disabilities, and child care providers who serve children who are on public aid programs. And the states, Illinois, California, Washington, a few others, force these individuals to accept a mandatory representative to bargain with the state over its Medicaid or child care program, effectively a mandatory lobbyist. And so after Harris versus Quinn held it was unconstitutional to force these individuals to pay dues, cases were brought mainly by the Right to Work Foundation challenging the constitutionality of extending exclusive representation beyond employees to individuals who are not government employees. There are several that were out there. Some, unfortunately, hit the court, Supreme Court, when it was deadlocked 4-4, but now there's several others behind them. One of which is called Bierman versus Dayton, and the petition for certiorari in that case will be filed in mid-December. and will present to the court whether it's constitutional to extend exclusive representation to non-employee providers. And then there's a second group of cases, the other seven, that deal with exclusive representation of public employees, many of which were brought by Buckeye, and those challenge public sector unionization. Can you extend exclusive representation of employees? And there's a signal, at least in Janus, we believe, that the court may be ready to look at this. The court held no less than three times that exclusive representation itself impinges on its associational rights, and that also noted that it's a significant impingement on associational rights that, quote, would not be tolerated in other contexts. So the hope in Bierman is that that other context they're referring to means these independent Medicaid providers. But I guess, you know, we'll all find out soon enough exactly what, if anything, the court meant about that. So those are sort of the three main categories of litigation we're seeing post-Janus: retroactive cases to claw back money taken in violation of Janus prior to the decision, prospective revocation window cases seeking to strike down restrictions on when employees can exercise their Janus rights, and then finally cases to extend Janus to private sector compulsory fees and to exclusive representation. So that's all I have in terms of opening remarks and sort of my view of what the world looks like out there post-Janus. And with that, open the floor for questions.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Not seeing any questions line up automatically. Did you want to delve any further into some of these issues, Bill, while we're waiting for a question?
Which one interests you?
What are the prospects in each of these areas? I mean, are some much more likely to succeed than others, or some doomed to fail? That was one thing I didn't seem to get completely clearly from your opening statements.
Well, given that I have cases in virtually all these categories, I'm going to say that they all have very high chance of success, and we're all very meritorious. As far as, you know, the actual chances, you know, one never knows how things are going to go in court. You know, all you can do is put forth the best argument and, you know, hope the judges or justices see it your way. But I do think that each of these various cases will turn on, or should turn on, one particular issue. You know, I think the clawback cases, the big issue is the good faith defense. If the courts don't buy that, they should succeed. If the court does, then they don't. And as mentioned, I think that given that there's so many of these cases and the issue here is so important, something the court came close to looking at before, eventually you might get a Supreme Court decision on that. And obviously, whichever way the Supreme Court goes could control the result of all the cases that are still pending, you know, at that time.
Right.
And then turning to the revocation cases, I think, you know, there's other arguments out there, but my opinion is they really turn on that waiver question to the extent you have a dues deduction agreement. And so, you know, we'll see what the courts think about that of, you know, what does constitute a First Amendment waiver in this context. The criteria is pretty well established of what a First Amendment waiver, and there's tons of cases on that. But in this context, it's something of a new issue for the courts, and we'll have to see how it comes out. And then the exclusive representation, you know, the first knock at the door, so to speak, will be the Bierman case soon, and we'll see, you know, how much interest the courts have, the Supreme Court at least, and then in the circuit courts, you know, there's a number of other cases, and, you know, all of which post-Janus, and we'll see what the courts do with it.
All right. Well, we do have two questions lined up now, so without further ado, we'll go to the first caller.
Hi, I have a question. Bill, it was a great presentation. My question is about the clawback cases. Have any of the unions made any kind of state action argument in those cases? That is saying, well, you know, we just told the state employer who was in the union, who wasn't. The state then took the money out of the employees' checks and gave it to us. We didn't engage in the unconstitutional conduct. The state did. And we're no more liable for that than, you know, a person who got a job from a discriminatory employer would be liable for the discrimination. So the question is, have any of the unions made an argument along those lines? And if so, have there been any judicial opinions about it?
Sure. I'm not aware of that argument being made. And it'd be difficult because besides, you know, the state deducting the money, almost all these deductions are done pursuant to collective bargaining agreements. So most state laws authorized compulsory union fees and dues deduction. However, unless there's a collective bargaining agreement, it's not necessarily automatic. It varies by state. So what you have is unions who negotiated in a collective bargaining agreement that the state will deduct these monies. And the union controls, usually, what monies the public employer deducts. In fact, California passed a law clarifying that public employers basically have to obey the union's voice when it comes to dues deduction. The union says deduct that money, the public employer has to do it. It can't make its own independent judgment of whether it's proper. So the union is very much, you know, responsible for the deductions happening. It can't claim that, you know, this is just money the state happened to throw in its lap without, you know, it being the driving force behind it. And then also that on top of that is, as I mentioned, there was a lot of litigation between Abood and Janus dealing with seizure of compulsory union fees. And those some of those lower court opinions, you know, fleshed out the state action point, that there is state action, you know, the union's collection of these fees and, you know, participation in the dues deduction process and such.
Thank you.
And we will now go to our next question.
Hi, I missed the clawback part, I apologize, but I assume from what you've said that the clawback argument by the union is basically until the Janus decision, Abood arguably was the law despite all the indications that the court was going to overturn Abood. And we relied in good faith on Abood, and therefore we shouldn't have to pay a dime. And if that argument is adopted, how deep is the slippery slope? I'm an employment lawyer, and if there is a prior decision, let's say from my circuit, but the Supreme Court's never spoken to the issue, or there's a prior decision in another circuit and nothing from mine, and my client has relied upon that, and then the law flips, either at the Supreme or in my circuit, and I say, good faith, the unions, let's assume the worst for you, the unions have won this clawback good faith argument. So I guess the question is, how deep could the slippery slope be if they win that issue?
That's a great point. And I think there is very much a slippery slope there. You know, if the courts look at the implications of what the union's arguing, I mean, the unions, you know, most of the briefing try to take the position of, well, this is a case where, you know, an existing Supreme Court precedent was overturned, although they should have saw it coming. But that put that apart, the question is a mistaken belief in law a defense? And if it is, why would that be limited just to where precedent is overturned? Could it just be good enough that there's a belief that we thought it was legal to do it? Or is any state statute that's passed, can the unions basically use it and not have any liability under it because it happened to be a statute? Like I gave the example of New Jersey. New Jersey passed a law saying you can't get out of the union except for basically during one 10-day period per year. So let's say the union denies a lot of people their right to get out based on that 10-day window. If there's a good faith defense after that window is struck down as invalid, does the union say we get to keep all the money? So how far that goes is a great question. And then sort of another point of, I indicated, if the union's position is true, this isn't just a rule just for unions. This would extend across 1983. So Section 42 U.S.C. 1983, you know, creates a private cause of action for deprivations of constitutional or federal statutory rights. It provides that the person who deprives it is liable to the injured party. The unions aren't arguing that bad faith is an element of a First Amendment deprivation. They're arguing that the state of mind, whether or not they had a good faith belief that, you know, what they did was legal, is a defense to Section 1983. So if that's true, that means every private sector defendant who acts under color of state law will now enjoy a good faith defense to what they did and a defense to paying damages to those who was injured by it. And in fact, it might not be limited just to private defendants. You know, municipalities and cities don't enjoy qualified immunity. Arguably, if, you know, state of mind is relevant to 1983, then perhaps a municipality and city can also say, hey, we thought what we did was, you know, legal under existing law or our read of the case law. Therefore, we're not liable for damages for the people we've injured by depriving them of their federal constitutional or statutory rights. So the implications of what the union's arguing here are really significant. And I don't know, these cases are just starting to move up. I don't know if the courts have quite grappled, you know, or really thought through of, you know, this, how big of a deal this is, you know, besides just the union context. But ultimately, we'll see. There's a few very terse decisions dealing with the good faith defense in the wake of Harris. The other cases dealing with a good faith defense recognized by several circuit courts dealt with a particular cause of action that actually required bad faith. It was basically a malicious prosecution action. So to show the deprivation, you had to show a particular intent. But whether or not there's a good faith defense to all private sector, or I'm sorry, all 1983 claims, is something that really hasn't been litigated yet, and we'll have to see what the courts do.
We have another question lined up, so without further ado, we'll go to the next question.
Hi, this is Roger Candelaria. First, I want to thank you for the clarity of your presentation. That's just really enlightening.
Thank you.
You talked about the legal implications, but I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what are the long-term political implications that might flow from either side winning in this in these three different categories of cases.
Sure. So political, in terms of the effect, you know, may have on unions, you know, some of the clawback suits, the amount of money involved is quite significant. On the other hand, you know, eventually it's sort of a one-time deal, so to speak. They've stopped taking agency fees. So as time rolls on and the statute of limitation rolls, you know, eventually there won't be any more clawback suits. At least not one's worth, you know, much money. So, but the, you know, I've never added up how much is involved in all these clawback suits put together, but it can be very significant in terms of the monetary liability the unions, you know, may be looking at, which also sort of also gives an indication of the scale of, you know, their constitutional violations prior to Janus. I mean, you know, this amount of money is money, you know, the unions illegally took from people. So in Riffey v. Rauner, which again, it was Harris versus Quinn, just renamed as the plaintiffs changed or defendants changed. That case, you know, is on behalf of 80,000 people seeking $32 million. So that means SEIU took $32 million from 80,000 people in violation of their First Amendment rights. So, you know, the return of that money, besides its effect on SEIU, you need to have very much, you know, the equitable point of making those individuals injured whole. So we have that. And then in terms of the revocation cases moving forward, you know, how much flexibility, if any, you know, states and unions have to restrict employees' rights under Janus with these dues deduction restrictions could have very significant impact on whether employees can actually exercise their Janus rights. To return to the situation in Ohio, you know, that basically had the dues deduction agreement said you can only get out one 15-day period every collective bargaining agreement. You know, if the courts hold that, the unions are going to run around the country getting every existing union member to sign something that says they can only get out once every 3 years. And if that's true, that really limits the ability of employees to exercise their rights, and particularly with respect to new employees, because new employees are very susceptible, you know, to signing whatever's really put in front of them when they start their employment. And the unions have turned to mandatory orientations for new hires and requirements that public employers provide union membership cards and such to new employees. The bottom line is between those two requirements, you know, the unions will probably be very effective at cajoling or otherwise getting new employees to sign these cards. And if the courts allow these cards to basically be waivers of their First Amendment rights under Janus for 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, whatever it is, the court, you know, the unions could significantly, you know, undermine the First Amendment rights recognized in Janus. So the hope is that, you know, the courts see through that and, you know, only, you know, permit, you know, a waiver of First Amendment rights if it, you know, truly is voluntary, clearly made and knowingly made. So those are sort of, you know, the stakes, you know, of those various forms of litigation. And then, of course, with the exclusive representation of providers, the unions, at least with respect to the Medicaid providers, you know, right now are forcing about 40,000 individuals, you know, who aren't public employees, who just received government money for their services, you know, to accept a mandatory union representative, whether they like it or not. And so if the exclusive representation challenges to those provider unions are successful, you know, all those individuals will be freed, you know, and free to choose whether or not they want to be part of the union or not, as opposed to forced to accept its representation. So those are sort of the stakes, you know, of the various three categories.
And not seeing any more questions currently lined up, did you want to offer any closing remarks?
No, I think we covered it. I think the questions, you know, were excellent and helped flesh out, you know, some of these points. And it's only been, what, 5 months since Janus, actually less, you know, 4 or 5 months. So a lot of this litigation now is really just starting to move. And so my guess is by this time next year, you know, we'll have a lot more clarity on, you know, what's happening with these various categories and perhaps do it again and do a follow-up, this teleform.
Absolutely. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our expert for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fed-soc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.